in our lives, we get so busy, or we get so skewed, that we're only attending to the things that are either, that cause us to bring up the negative feelings within us, or else we're just kind of going through our day taking care of business kind of as a neutral zone. It's too bad. Because, as I said, we are human beings, and we are nurtured by beauty. And that is always available to us. We forget in our own preoccupation that beauty is always available to us. Flowers are always available to us. It's not in our yard, in our neighbor's yard. The sky is always available to us. Human beings are always available to us. It's interesting that in the development of Buddhism in Asia, things like flower arranging, tea ceremonies, Zen gardens, things that are very simple, like flowers and drinking tea or having a little garden, but become places where one can practice mindfulness and awareness, but also get in touch with something beautiful and calm. So please remember that. We all have homes, we all have places we live. Do we bring beauty into that? Do we bring flowers? Do we bring plants? And when we go about our day, do we remember to notice the sky, the clouds, the trees, and the people? Do we take opportunities in our day to stop and nourish ourselves? So when we're drinking a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, we're really doing it with mindfulness, presence. So we really taste, right? And we smell, and we feel. But most of the time, all these things, we're not present. Right? We're drinking our cup of tea or coffee, but we're doing something else. We're thinking something else. So we don't have the experience where, you know, we're walking, but we're not present to what our eyes are seeing or what we're smelling. We're preoccupied with where we're getting to, or something's on our mind, or where we just left. So all these opportunities that are right, they're always available to us in our lives. We do not touch. We are not present. And we are the losers. The flowers aren't the losers. Flowers are just the flowers. The sky is just the sky. The clouds are just the clouds. But we are the losers because we have forgotten the necessity that being a human being is being able to be present to the things of beauty in this world. And if we get, you know, and if we get too neutral, because we're just, you know, a busybody, right? Just always taking care of our busyness, as many of us are. Or if we get skewed toward the stress, the frustration, the anger, the sad, you know. And if that's all we're attending to, well, no wonder there's no joy in our life. I mean, how could there be joy? There's no room for joy in that kind of life. Is that clear? Now, again, because things are so busy in our lives, if we are not conscious, it is very easy to get swept into just being somebody who does. Right? We know we have a society that prides people on what? Being productive. You know? It's like, you know, the more I can do in a day, right? The better a human being I am. I mean, it's nonsense. And the sick thing is, we have gotten sucked into it. So even though more and more we need drugs and alcohol, legal and illegal, you know what I mean? And all kinds of addictions. I mean, this is all symptomatic that we have lost the human capacity to be happy.
at peace in our lives. So more and more we need artificial stimulations or substances to give us a sense of peace or happiness. So we have to be aware that there is another way. And to say that it's a way that goes back thousands of years is to acknowledge that it is a way that has been produced by human beings for thousands of years. Human beings for thousands of years have looked at life and looked at what makes life meaningful and what makes life meaningless. Have looked at what makes life a source of happiness and joy and what makes life a source of suffering and pain. And we are lucky. The rather than just keeping that secret to themselves, they have shared it. And so there is a lot of wisdom, human wisdom. Human means people like us, who have looked seriously at life, human life, and have developed ways for us to live that produces a life of meaning and happiness and joy, peace, calmness, compassion. And it is available to us. But, you know, as they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. It's available to us, but we have to be willing to drink, and we have to be willing to stop drinking those things that either produce pain and suffering for us, or else have no nutritional value. You know, there's lots of foods out there, right, that people eat. It's called junk food. Right. It's called junk food because why? It looks like food, right? look at it. It looks like, it's solid, it's got taste, it's got color, right? It looks like food, doesn't it? So if we're not conscious and if we don't look at the ingredients, right, we can think, oh, I'll eat this and I'll get some nutrition for my body. That's what that's what we're supposed to be eating. it's like a body thing. So our body thing, it's like fuel for our body, right? You don't even know that. But that's what we're supposed to be eating. But because we have forgotten that, we buy junk food that has no nutritional value. It fills us up, right? In the moment, but in the long term, it is doing harm to us. That's what junk food is. And we know that junk food is not denying. Because if you're filling yourself up with junk food, you're not getting nutritious food. And if you're not getting nutritious food, it will show up. Right? And if anybody follows the healthcare debate, we're involved in, we understand whatever problem the healthcare system is in, we human beings with our health in this are even worse off. Right? Because we're suffering from endless kinds of diseases that are self-created, that are based on our diet and our lifestyle. Right? I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm not going to go into that. But I guess what I'm saying that in the human realm, in the realm of experience, there's also lots of junk experiences. Things we do, things that take up our day, things that take up our time, but there's no nutritional value for our heart, for our soul, for our mind. Right? And we all know what it is. Because we spend lots of time at that, right? And yet at the end of it, are we happy? At the end of surfing the computer, I'm not talking about if you actually have work to do or you're really. But when they're just surfing, just constantly moving back and forth. Is it, are those kinds of activities producing well-being? Peace of mind, harmony, and heartful connection. If they're not, these are junk experiences. Just like junk food, they're junk experiences. Again, if we don't see it, if we're not willing to take, you know, it's the same way, if we're not willing to read, you know, the label, looks like real food, right? And then you look at the label and you realize, well, it's all filled. It's all filled with a lot of sugar, of corn syrup. We have to be willing to look at our experiences the same way. What are the ingredients in this experience? And are they going to produce for me what, you know, kind of mind kind of feeling? Because I want to be in the books of experience within myself. If not, then why are we eating that? Why are we consuming that? In Buddhist psychology, it is often said that, you know, it's interesting the word diet, right? Like, you know, what we consume physically. There's also the sense that our, I mean, not the sense, but the idea that our mind and our senses also consume. Our eyes consume sights, our ears consume sounds, our nose consume smell, right? And our awareness, our mind, consumes thoughts, feelings, perceptions, right? If you think about it, these are all things that we're taking in. In the same way that our body is taking in the food we eat and is digesting it, and then it becomes part of us, right? We are what we eat. So when we consume food and we digest it, it becomes our physical body. When we consume experiences, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, interactions, our mind, this is the food of our mind. And what does it leave you with? It leaves you with a certain kind of mind. We have the mind we have the emotions we have because of our history of consumption. What our mind is consuming, the kind of experiences we consume. We don't just consume with our mouth. We consume with our ears, our nose, our eyes, and our mind. So, what the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings give us is the understanding that that is what's going on. And we have to be mindful and attentive and aware in terms of what all of us is consuming, not just our mind. So, in a certain sense, we are what we eat, but we also are what we think. We are what we feel. And so if what all we're thinking is negative, then we will become what? Negative. How can it be otherwise? If all we're consuming is comfort, if all we're consuming is fear, if all we're consuming is desire, is all we're, you know what I'm saying? I could go on and on, but I think you get the point. There's no mystery here. With the psychology, you know, the law of cause and effect is quite simple. This is occurring because of that. There always has to be an instinct. Things don't come out of nowhere. Everything is caused by something else. So, why do I have the mind I have? Because what? Because of my thoughts, feelings, perceptions that I have nourished in the past. They arise in the person. It doesn't come out of the ether. It's out of my experience. On the other hand, how do I want my future to be?
What am I thinking, feeling, acting right now?
Because I'm, you know, this will be causing that. That caused this, this causes that. When I get that, then I know right here, in the present moment, in my actions of body, speech, and mind, I have the power to transform what is arising in the present from the past. As well as I have the power to transform my future by being very careful what's going on in the present. But if I'm unaware, then what? This will just continue and it will manifest and it'll just keep going on. Can you see? It's just cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. And if there's no consciousness, if there's no awareness, if there's nobody stepping in, right, to change things, then we will simply be people who are driven by our past. Unconsciously driven by our past. And that will create a continuation on forever, right? I mean, and it doesn't even just last one lifetime. I mean, now I'm not talking about rebirth or incarnation. We'll leave it. But many of us are acting out our parents, right? It's just being passed down, and nobody's conscious. So many of us are just acting out the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, acting body, speech, and mind of our parents or grandparents. Just got passed down. Everybody just continues on. Good and bad. I'm not saying it's all bad. It's good and bad. We're just continuing the practice. And we never stop. So what's really going on? What do I want? You know, what have I inherited from my ancestors that is worthy? Produces goodness, happiness, well-being. Right. These I want to preserve. These I may want to even what? Develop more. These are the good things that my ancestors, my parents, have transmitted to me. So I'm happy about it. But we also know that not all our ancestors' parents had it all together, did they? So they transmitted their sufferings, their fears, their anger. Their frustrations, their loneliness, their sadness, right? Their addictions, their incapacities to what's true. Not because they were bad people, they just didn't want it. Now those, we may say, why do you keep passing them on? Why continue passing them on? For myself, for my continuation, children, friends, family, the way they don't mind. Is this what I want to keep passing down? Right? Maybe there's no reason. Maybe it's time to stop. And to look deeply. And to go, yeah, these things are good. I want to continue them. My whole life, my continuation, these, no. These need to be transformed, healed and transformed. So our, you know, our parents are not that far away from us. Our ancestors, grandparents, great-grandparents, they're very much alive in us. I'm sure if you know, we can hear them talking to you. You often will stop and you know, oh, this is how my mother felt. This is how my father felt. This is the way it is. So, you know, we are not so unique as we think. So we, in a very interesting way, we do have the power, the capacity to transform the suffering of our ancestors. Very wonderful. They may be physically dead, but they are alive in us. And we don't have to continue. We can transform, we can heal our parents in us, our grandparents. Because they didn't do, many of them had, as we know, as Americans, you know, many of our ancestors had difficult lives. That's why they came here. They had difficult lives. So therefore, they wanted something better, but they had a lot of suffering. A lot of suffering that probably led them to come to America, and then a lot of suffering as they tried to establish themselves. They didn't have the time or energy nor the exposed to the ways of transformation in here. But we are lucky. So it's good to reflect on that. Not to be critical of them, but to understand our parents and our ancestors. And to realize that they are alive enough, whether we like it or not, and that we have the power to transform, to heal them. So before we get into the formal teaching, let me just say something. I realize that in all the things we're doing today, I never come to that schedule. So really living in the moment. But basically, probably Dharma talk and discussion will probably go to around 12:30. And then we'll have our lunch break. Again, it'll be a silent lunch, which means just to eat. We have an opportunity today to look at our food, to taste our food, and even to reflect on it. Because none of us grew the food that we ate. Somebody else grew it, somebody else manufactured it, processed it. So you may be, if you look deeply at the food you're eating, you may see the labor of many, many, many people. And not just in America. These days, you know, it could be coming from all over the world. As well as, you know, you look even more deeply, we see what? We see earth, sky, and rain, and clouds, also present in our food. So it's good to stop and just look deeply. And that's what we'll be doing during the lunchtime. You go outside, enjoy yourself, enjoy the beauty. And then after that, the bell will ring, calling us back in, and we'll have something very nourishing, which is a deep relaxation with a special kind of meditation that goes along with it. I think it's kind of very nourishing for your mind and your body. And then after that, Val, this is her studio, will lead us in mindful movements, stretching, movement. And then we'll have our final meditation and then our closing ceremony. So they move very quickly. So before we get into a formal talk, for those who are new, we always have time for questions. This is an opportunity, if you have any questions about the practices that we did today, about practice in general, or any questions you have about anything that maybe I've said so far, or just in your own life, how to bring these practices into your life. So if anybody has any questions, please feel free to
healing and transforming our inheritance, is that by just being aware of the thoughts and the feelings and the perceptions and letting them go as best we can?
Yes and no. I think generally, kind of general, what we do is we are present to whatever's arising. We don't push anything away. And we hold whatever arises in our presence and awareness. In that way, we do not feed or intensify what is arising from the past. So that's good. But it often doesn't deal with the deeper thing, which is the source of the suffering, the source of this fear, the source of this anger, the source of this longing. So oftentimes the healing transformation comes from looking more deeply into really doing healing transformative work. On the healing side, we can say, well, there are parts of us that have been wounded in the course of our life, from our childhood to adolescence. There is a wound inside us, in our psyche, in our hearts, in our emotions, whatever we want, in our mind. And oftentimes that hurt part of ourselves, that wounded part of ourselves, is very alive today. It's as alive today as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago. He or she still is alive and still reacting to situations in the same way they did 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So, if that is what's happening with us, we need to really go deeply into that part of ourselves. And to me, the healing power that each of us have is to bring understanding and compassion to that part of ourselves. Because if that part of ourselves and whatever experience has traumatized us, of course, caused us to have this emotional wounding, if in that experience we had been met with understanding and loving compassion, the wounding would have either not occurred or would have healed very quickly. So it's usually because that did not occur then that this emotional wound continues. It continues to be reactive. So, in that sense, the healing has to be more focused. And we bring the tools of love and understanding. Understanding means, you know, oftentimes we've internalized these wounds very personally. Something wrong with me, something I did, something they did to me. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of personal a lot of self around, and a lot of misunderstanding about causes and conditions. What really causes to arise? What caused them to do what they did? What caused me to respond the way I did? And so oftentimes we have a whole story that's very skewed and immature because we often had these experiences either when we were young or we were just kind of screwed up. So our capacity to kind of see clearly what was going on was really not possible. But now we have the possibility because we are clear enough and we have tools. We have tools of mindfulness. We have tools of looking. We have tools of understanding. We have tools of compassion, loving kindness, right? To now go to this place, go to this place, and use these tools to heal. And the healing allows a transformation. I can transform myself into somebody who lives in fear to somebody who lives courageously. I can transform myself from somebody who lives always in bitterness or frustration and anger into someone who lives in acceptance and understanding and love. I mean, I can transform myself because I'm transforming these parts of myself that I've inherited. It's like what we talked earlier. You've inherited. We didn't go out looking for this stuff, did we? I don't think there's anybody here who went through life looking for woundings. And if we did, it shows you how sick we were. That should be proof. That was not it. We just didn't know better. We were just in a very dependent situation. So, please understand, Buddhist teaching is only about the illumination, alleviation of suffering. And so we need to use our practice transform these parts of ourselves.
And people say, well, how often should I do it?
My response is, you do it as long as you need to do it.
When you no longer feel the wound, when you no longer feel the pain, you'll know healing is taking place. It's really quite simple. How long do you have to care for the wound, the physical wound, until it's healed? Well, how do you know when it's healed? It no longer hurts, it no longer looks numb, stuff isn't coming out of it, it's kind of scar over. How do you know it's healed? It's the same way with our emotions. How do we, you know, there is a healing. It's not just talk. Healing is when we're no longer in pain and suffering, no longer controlled by these woundings of the past. And they no longer arise emotionally in situations, nor do they affect our behavior. And this is what the practice at a deep level is about. One level, the practice helps us live more calmly in our daily life, have more peace of mind. That's this one. But like you said, there's still deeper sufferings within us that we've inherited from the past. And so, at a deeper level, the practice is really about including that, the freeing. You hear a lot of spiritual practice about freedom, right? When you're free, when you're liberated. Well, what does it mean? What do you want to be free from? What do you want to be liberated from? You want to be free and liberated from your suffering. You want to be free to be the wise, understanding, intelligent, loving, peaceful human being that you really have the capacity to be and the right to be. Any more questions? Yes.
The lawnmower really made me angry.
Good. I'm glad you noticed.
No one really couldn't support that. And I'm glad that what your comment that the peace comes from inside, and even knowing that and kind of understanding this a little bit, still is really difficult.
Yeah, because what happened? The lawnmower goes off, and then what do we do? What's your name again?
Chip.
That's right, Chip. So what happens? So there's a sound, right? And Chip goes what?
Why?
Because Chip has an idea in his head that what's not supposed to be happening to me. Right? Today is day of mindful, day of peace, and lawnmowers are not allowed, right?
Not in Chip's world.
Right? So, you know, we laugh, but I think that this is very important. This is the practice. The practice is being present to what arises. And when you see anger arise, frustration arise, that shows your practice in Chip. You know, if you, now, you really start practicing when you just don't let that continue. You realize, right, what's going on. It's just myself, my ego, trying to control it. Right? Chip doesn't, right? Chip is not just satisfied just being here, right? He wants to control all out there, doesn't he? Right? I mean, you could get, you know, there's something like planes fly over here, right? I mean, we could get really angry at that. Right? We might get with the whole control airplane system and flight patterns, right? We could get bigger and bigger cameras. And yet the truth is what? All there is a sound coming to the ear that we decide is unpleasant. And not only is it unpleasant, it shouldn't be happening.
And then we repeat the thoughts, we get angry, frustrated inside, and all of a sudden our equanimity, our peace of mind, our day of mindfulness is what? Destroyed. And ordinary beings who do not understand reality believe the problem is the God. And is God damn right? That's what we think. He's disturbing my peace. And that is a terrible way to live. Because when we live that way, right, when we live that way, who's got control of our happiness?
The lawnmower.
The lawnmower, the man from the world. Right? I mean, if I was a control freak, right, and I wanted control, I wouldn't give it to the external world, would I? Because you can't control the external. You'll only be angry. You'll only be fighting with people, right? You'll be running out there, threatening the guy. you know what I mean? And so you'll take care of that one. So the next one goes, right? And that's where many people live their lives. There's an easier way to take care of this guy who's on. Calm him. Tell him to let go. Just let go. Just a moment. Just a second. Let's get a right to be here.
Does that, I guess what I'd like to know is,
yes,
practicing this way of life, does that actually happen with you people in here? I mean, I'm sure it does for some of you, but how long does it take at that point?
Well, I'd say it takes about 5 seconds. Chip, you ever hear about the word suffering? In Buddhism, it's called dukkha, suffering. Okay. You ever heard the word nirvana? Nirvana means what?
Enlightenment.
Or absence of suffering. So, Chip, when you're there, right, you're in the world of suffering. As soon as you say to Chip, let go, Chip, really, let's come back to you. In that moment, you have let go of your suffering. Right? And immediately you experience what?
Nirvana.
And this is not the great nirvana, but this is the small nirvana. In that moment, you have let go, and you've restored peace. You freed yourself from suffering, and you're in the moment. How long did that take? Just a couple seconds. That's how long did it take us? I mean, don't make a big deal about it. You know, see how we kind of go, well, I want it all the time. Right? How long do we get all the time? I don't know. 100 lifetimes, 1,000 lifetimes. Who knows? But how long does it take for Chip to go from being in the world of suffering to being in the world of non-suffering? It takes 5 to 10 seconds. Can you see what I'm saying? Sometimes, you know, this is like, that's an easy one. Sometimes, you know, in our life, our relationships, they're a little more knotty. It may take us what? It may take us 10 minutes, right? Or 15 minutes, or 30 minutes, or 60 minutes. For a couple of hours to restore us, to let go. You know, it's interesting. In Buddhist practice, we are grateful to people like that. Yeah, he's waking us up. He's going, you know, can you let go? I mean, Chip knows at this moment, he probably knew before, but in this moment, he's learned something about what causes him suffering. Let's say he didn't know that before, but now he knows it clearly. You only learn that because of that guy. You go out there afterwards and you bow. You say, thank you. You know, you helped me learn something today.
if you would come in here today and everything had been peaceful and wonderful, right, and you kind of blissed out, right? And then on your way home, right, somebody cuts you off or somebody's going too slow in your lane, that, see, the whole day wouldn't have been helpful. It would just been a nice day, like getting high or something. You don't learn anything. That's why it's a path of understanding. And now you understand what causes Chip to suffer and what causes Chip to be free of suffering. And he taught you. So in that sense, we began. It's not like we go looking for suffering. But when it arises, situations like that, it's just kind of, we can get back and see what's going on. What is causing me in this moment to suffer? Or again, in our interactions with others, right? Like, let's say I'm interacting with you. Right? I'm sure each of us, we interact with other people, don't we? Who share with us their suffering. But they don't have a clue about it, do they? They'll tell you they're suffering because of this person or that person. Or this, you know what I mean? And we'll listen to them and we'll just feed their suffering. But now, right, you have the ability now to go, oh. And when somebody tells you a story about they were there, can you believe this? Son of a gun, they're there, they're all there. And now Chip can go, hold on a second. Where did your suffering come from? Did it really come from that person, or did it come from the way you reacted to something? Where is your suffering? Where's your sadness? Where's your anger? Where's your frustration? Where's your fear? It's here. How did that happen? Did that guy put the anger in you? You didn't really have to be sick to say that, right? But when we talk that way, right? We say, what? Oh, she made me angry. Right? I mean, it's like magical thinking. We're like children. I mean, did you make yourself? No. Chip made yourself. And when you understand that Chip is the only one who makes you suffer in this life, that's good, because now you know, oh, if I want to be happy, who do I have to work with? I can work with Chip. That's all. Before that, we think, what? We have all these people in the world that we've got to get straight. Right? We're going to straighten this one up, and that one up, and now I'm going to get this one up, doing it all the way, you know what I mean? Right? And there are a lot of people who they're very busy in this life, straightening everybody else out. Right? And getting them to go along with our agenda. I wonder why we're exhausted. Or always frustrated. But when we step back, I guess we can see what, right? It's a no-brainer. It doesn't work. So Chip, the source of your suffering is
Chip.
Can you see how wonderful that is? You don't think I'm going to go up?
Gives me all the power.
Yeah, now you have power. Can you see that? If you think it's everybody else, can you see how powerless that is? Right? You're the victim. But once you go, no. So it's very empowering to know source of my suffering.
Chip, you know, when Chip,
rather than going with the story,
goes, I'm aware that there's frustration. I'm aware that there's anger. Oh, that's interesting. You see, now that's the practice of mindfulness. I know in the moment what is arising. And I'm present. I'm not running away from it. I'm not distorting it. I'm not suppressing it. But nor am I going with it. This is the practice. I know there's anger. I know there's fear. I know there's sadness. I know there's jealousy. I know there's judgment. You know, whatever it is. Okay. And now, what am I going to do with it? Sometimes, it's simply just letting it go, you know, because it's not a big deal. But sometimes, like you said earlier, sometimes these things are a big deal. We see there's a pattern here. Right? The chip goes, I know there's a sense of frustration. I spend half my day here. Right? You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Oh, so this is maybe needs a little special attention. Like, this is not just a kind of, you know, thing that happens during the day. Oh, you know, let it go. There's lots of those, right? But this is something that I know this one. And I want to look deeply at this. I want to give this some good attention. See if there's any kind of healing that needs to be done. Any kind of deep looking that needs to be done. Not that, that's the practice. Any other questions, comments? Yes?
Yeah, a little fundamental question about meditating. When I do, I find that I'm so focused on if my posture is okay or not. But I can't seem to get clear-headed. I can't seem to focus on my breathing. So I feel like my back hurts all the time. Am I sitting too tall? Am I sitting too much?
So again, this is why it's important in the beginning to find, first of all, it takes, we are not a culture that sits on the floor. Understand that, the Buddhas with their, and yogis or whatever, with their half lotuses and full lotuses. Don't forget, they're in a culture where everybody sat on the floor, except I guess nobility. Okay? But everybody sat on the floor, of course, like it. So there was people who used to sit on the floor. They had flexibility in their joints, okay, and so therefore, you know, getting a little more stable into a lotus posture or something was just kind of a step up. But the body was already flexible. So please understand that for most of us, unless we do a lot of yoga or have a natural flexibility, you know, when we come to sit, it's not going to be so easy. So you want it. That's why as you look around, you'll see cushions, and we have back jacks, and we have these benches, and we have things that help us get stable. So having said that, obviously doing things like yoga or stretching something is easier, but just find a posture for yourself that works. Okay? And even if you have to sit in a chair, that's fine. Okay? I mean, the important thing is that you find a posture in which your body feels stable and which you are upright. The important thing is really to have that straight back. Because we know, just without being with yogis or anything, we know that when we are tired or stressed, we tend to slump. Right? And we know if we want to wake ourselves up, we go like, you can see, we naturally kind of do like this, right? Kind of, an erect spine, seems to be more energetic. So that's why usually, this stuff is like supportive stuff, but the straight spine is usually most important. So you want to now again, it's sort of like Chip said, it's interesting what our mind does. Right? So that is why I like to say to people, if it's a little uncomfortable, that's okay. If it gets painful, well then maybe undo your legs or move. But it's interesting because our mind will just start telling a story. And all of a sudden it's all about this uncomfortability, the bell going to ring, or Right, you start judging yourself, what's wrong with me, nobody else is moving, I'm moving. You see what I'm saying? So again, if you can just step back and watch, this is a trick symptom. Right? What I'm doing with the simple reality is there's a little discomfort in my knees. And that's a reality. It's not life-threatening. Right? So we learn. And you may notice, I think I do this a lot after periods of my life. This is interesting. And you just bring your awareness. So in that sense, it's sort of like Chip's saying, it's sort of like the uncomfortableness in your body, rather than being something negative, becomes something interesting. You learn about yourself. How do I handle uncomfortableness? Am I somebody who, as soon as I'm physically or emotionally uncomfortable, I'm not happy? I got to get away from it. A lot of people are very uncomfortable with uncomfortable feelings. Right away, they want to suppress them, change the subject. Have something to drink, right? Because I don't want to feel. So, can you see this? There's just in this simple act of sitting, there's a lot of learning. Because we deal with things that arise, uncomfortableness in our body arises, and how we react. A lot of people get into a lot of judgment in their practice. Wrong. I shouldn't have all these thoughts. I'm a bad practitioner. I should be better than I am. You know what I mean? All that stuff. And everybody else is better. Can you see? That's our stuff, isn't it? That's all our stuff. Rather than just being present to whatever arises, with a mind of equanimity, you start. And so again, there's a lot of learning. How am I approaching this like competition? Comparing myself to everybody else. And most of us what? Most of us want to be the best. Come on, games. A's, right? You want to get A's. Or else, if our history in school is always where we're on the C, D, E side of things, we go, here I am again, I'm a failure. Once again, I'm the last one of the class, nobody's getting it, I'm not getting it. Can you see? In the practice we stop and go, where is this coming from? All that's going on is I'm sitting here, right, breathing, and thoughts are aroused. Right? Am I right? Isn't that what's going on here? Everything else is the story. And the story that each of us is telling is caused by conditions from our past. That's what somebody's telling me, Type A types are telling me, how come I'm not succeeding? Aren't I the good surprise? Type E types are going, here I am again, the last one is going to have a failure, screw up. You know what I mean? It's just your conditioning. That's bringing this. And so again, in this practice, we use whatever arises as a focus. Liberation. Freedom. From what? People throw these terms around. What does it mean? It means that. I want to be free from all my judgments. Right? I want to be free from this thing that I think is something, why am I getting it right? I want to be free from what's comparing myself to other people. That's what I want to be free of. Why? Because it causes me suffering. They don't produce a sense of well-being inside. If you don't have a sense of well-being or ease in your body, mind, you're suffering. And we do understand that each of us have the capacity to be at ease, and to be happy, and to be peaceful inside. Then we'll look at all these states which pass for normal. And there are a lot of people that live lives that really aren't that great, are they? And yet they think it's normal. You don't know what normal is. We think, running endlessly, being productive, going down our food, never having time to be with the people we love, never having time to, you know, to enjoy nature and beauty and relationships, never having time to meditate, never having, you know, and just running around being productive, stressed beings is normal. It's not normal. It's abnormal. How do you know it's abnormal? Because it produces disease. And if you look again, if you look at our rate of those of us who are taking antidepressants and anti-anxieties and anti, you know what I mean, and all this, this is symptomatic of something deeper in our society. We are not leading lives that produce well-being. Dharma. Now, when I say Dharma, I don't just mean the Buddha's Dharma. That's it. It's be my Dharma. I'm not a salesman. I don't have the franchise, and I don't make any money off it, so I don't have to, you know. But we need a Dharma. Everybody needs a Dharma, a way to liberate themselves from their suffering. A way that produces happiness and well-being. Everybody needs a Dharma. And we live in a world now because that has been forgotten. And people think all you need is what? A good job. Right? Status. And then you'll be happy. And if we keep going as if it's true. I'll ask you. Just say whatever. What produces happiness, well-being, ease, calmness, peace of mind? Just anybody can say. You don't have to raise your
hand.
What? Amic. Resting
now.
Meditation. Art.
Nature. My dog.
Your dog.
Exercise.
Family. Exercise. Cooking.
Chopping vegetables.
The dog park.
Loving kindness. I mean, what is it? Right? Joy, pain. The ease of us. What else? Ease, well-being, peace of mind.
Babies.
Family.
This day.
Clowns. I mean, think of the list we just made. Mm. And think about how we spend our days and our lives. What's central? I mean, can you see how simple it is? Okay, I mean, there is a reality. You know, we have to see it ourselves. I mean, this is not denying the reality, but, you know, so, you know, these are the things that produce happiness and well-being inside us. If we say, well, I'm 95% or 98% over here, you know, 2% over here, we don't feel balanced. No wonder we don't feel whole, we don't feel integrated. You see, there's no mystery. Okay? There's a reality. Look at how we're dealing with reality. I mean, the reality of having a living and capabilities and all that with what we know is most meaningful in life. It wasn't too many generations ago when people had a better sense of that than that. But we're so skewed. The person who spends the most time at work is somehow the one who's most offensive. It's like sick. I mean, nobody mentioned going to work. Now, again, we all have to go to work, but I mean, it's like, right? How about the person who goes to work but also spends a lot of time with their family? Because that's me. Who spends a lot of time with their art, with nature, with their dog. Again, unfortunately, we live in a society where if we're not very conscious, it's very easily to get swept up in another kind of life. Your own values about what's important in life are not even not good for. If they're not, we'll get sick. We'll get stressed. All kinds of physical and mental kind of disorders within us. It has to be there. So again, you know, meditation. Meditation in Buddhism. Many of us begin our meditation practice really thinking meditation as an antidote to all the things we just talked about and escape from. But it really shouldn't be that. Meditation should be that process that brings us in touch with reality. And allows us to see clear what's going on in the reality of life so we can live in a meaningful way, so we can make meaningful choices. Meditation reveals all that. Mindfulness reveals all that to us. But we have to use it in that way. I mean, I can have a flashlight, and I can just shine it up into the air. There's not much use in that, is there? Or I can use the flashlight to look in my room for something that I need. Or I hear a sound over there, and I'm a little worried what that is. I'm trying to flash out over there so I can see clearly. So just having a flashlight is kind of neutral. It's really, where am I shining the flashlight? And one of the things we do in meditation is we shine the flashlight of awareness here. So our practice is, before Chip came here today, his practice was paying attention to the outside world. What's that guy over there doing? What's that one over there doing? What did this one shape off? What did that one do? Right? But now they go, no, I need to shine my mindfulness, my awareness on myself. What am I feeling? What am I thinking? What am I saying? Where is that coming? So, again, mindfulness is a tool, but the practice teaches us how to use it in meaningful ways so, again, we can liberate ourselves. I'm just using my mindfulness to pay attention to everybody else. Well, there may be some stuff in that for us, I don't know. But it's not really going to liberate us from ourselves. Unless, again, as I'm attending to other people, I'm looking deeply. I'm really trying to use my mindfulness to really understand what is it that is causing them to suffer. And what is it that they can do that will free them from that? In all sense, I'm using my mindfulness in a good way. Even though it's not necessarily focused on me. Any other questions?
What do you do when you have something to a cup? It seems like when you're sitting, it's a lot easier to just let go of the sound of the lawnmower than when you're at work and you have some task, or at home and you have some task that you need accomplished, or you need a whole group of people to accomplish. Because in that, aren't you, in essence, needing to sort of control or guide other people? You can't just let go and...
Yeah. So that's a great point, because there is the reality of our lives. And to me, our individual meditation practice that we can do at home, or when we go, like, you know, Tampa, we have Thursday night, a Wednesday night, we have a day of mindfulness like today. You might be in parts of other meditation groups, right? To me, that's like, you know, if you're a researcher, when you first do your experiment, you usually do it in laboratory conditions, right? Ideal conditions, where all the variables can be controlled. Because you want to see whether the thing works or not. Okay? All right. So that's what this is. This is our laboratory, and even though we, you know, even here in our laboratory, sounds arise that we can't control, basically we can say this is ideal conditions, right? I mean, we don't have any responsibilities. You know, all we do is listen to the bell when we sit up, we stand. It's over. Everything's provided for us. It's a nice day. You know, we're hopefully all here with people who are like-minded. You know, when we walk in this way, everybody walks in that way. We don't have people walking the other way. You know, when we're trying to sit, we don't have people next to us, you know, making noises or poking us or making faces at us. Or, I don't have any idea, right? So these are ideal conditions. And what we're trying to learn in these ideal conditions is how to do the prayer. The ideal conditions hopefully support us in learning the practice.
The practice training is exactly what?
Mindfulness. Awareness.
Awareness of what's going on in the present.
Right. But also, we practice awareness of the breath. Now, awareness of the breath is a very interesting practice. There are many practices in Buddhism, but the breath is the fundamental. Why? And for somebody like you, it's good because what you're doing is developing a relationship that ties your awareness, your mindfulness, with your breath. So now you have something at work, because you are breathing at work, and you are breathing when you're home. Right. So the good thing about breath awareness, it's not something like a visualization or a mantra or something else that you have to bring into the mind. Right. It's already there. Our body is always breathing. So again, developing a relationship with the breath. Because that's learning how to sit, how to walk, how to eat, and so maintaining awareness of the breath can be very grounding and help bring you back. So, mindfulness means being present to whatever's arising moment to moment. Mindfulness of the breath gives it a little more specific. So we have, let's say these two. All right. So, what kind of work do you do? Okay, and what kind of, but in the family, for example, what kind of work you might do, maybe what? I do it frequently. So you deal a lot with what? Numbers. So when you're dealing with the numbers, right, you are present. Your mind is not in the past or future, you're not thinking about anything. You're totally present. So whatever you're doing. And you can also be a little bit aware, perhaps, or just use your breath to kind of calm you and stabilize you as you're doing your numbers.
Also, your Zen Cam, you have to deal with clients. So when you're with your client, your mindfulness practice is fine. When they talk, you listen. When you talk, you just, you know what I'm saying? But you're just present, fully present. This is your practice. Be present. In the moment. Totally focused, totally there, 100%. If you're in a planning meeting, you're just there in the planning meeting. Totally focused on the agenda, totally focused on what's going on. And if you have the capacity also to kind of stay present to yourself in your breath, maybe with 10% of your awareness. And keep you grounded, keep you from flying off. But again, we have in our life, besides what we do, we also have transition. The meeting's over. And you're walking back to your office. Can you take the minute or two as you're walking? To practice walking. Just ground yourself. Stabilize yourself. Come back. The phone rings. You don't have to pick it up the first time. Come on, the phone rings. Use the first three rings to go. Bell of mindfulness. Get off a phone call. Before you go back to your task, take a minute. Just a minute. Feel your body. Come back. So, when we're driving in the car, I mean, there's lots of opportunities throughout the day to ground ourselves, stabilize ourselves, calm ourselves. Even if we have a fairly active life. Even if because of personal, family, work, we have to be fairly active, there are breaks. They may be short, they may be a minute, they may be 5 minutes, they may be 10 minutes. You know. And let me just say to us, we are so filled with our self-importance, it's disgusting. We think everything we do is the most important thing in the world, we've got to get it done right now. Doesn't have to be done somehow. So we can, before I go on to do this, I can take 10 minutes. Just to look at the sky, look at the flower, breathe, enjoy a cup of tea. I mean, very few of us are dealing with earth-shaking things. Get done right now, somehow the world's going to fall apart. I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe people in here who have those kinds of responsibilities. But I don't think so. But in our mind, our personal drama has become so significant to us. We somehow think of it. You know, we're almost like, we've got to relax. Stop taking our lives so seriously. Now, that saying that, that does not mean it's going to go the other extreme. We have work responsibilities, we have family responsibilities, we have responsibilities in our society, in our communities, and many of us can be involved in painful things. But if we're not at peace, our mind is full of emotionality and stress. And what is our capacity to be there for us? I mean, we may be in relationship right now, family, with friends, with significant people. Are we really present to them when we're with them? Or are we all a bunch of stressed out, tired people kind of going through the motions? How attentive are we to the people we live with? How personal? How connected? So if we are not
at ease if we don't have the capacity for being present. Then, our work, our families, what are we bringing to the table? I think what this practice tells us is it begins with me. Sometimes people say, talking in early stages of practice, meditating is, I feel guilty. Or people say it's selfish. Maybe some of you are here today, and some people in your life think you're very selfish. Take a day just for yourself. You might think you're selfish. And there could be people who aren't here because they feel that would be selfish or self-indulgent. Or they feel guilty. Look at my to-do list. More important than your own well-being. To me, what we're doing here today is because of that. It's because of your relationships, your family, your friendships, that you want a day like this to nourish yourself. So you can be there with them in a truly meaningful way. A lot of people in this world, they're like, they're not present. And they're just running through their life, kind of like bouncing off each other. You know what I mean? We're not really connecting. We kind of bounce. We get a mask on, we have a way of talking, and there's no real connection. There's no real authenticity in the way of talking. To me, the practice is about that. How can I be present and authentic with you if I'm not living authentically myself? So at the deepest level, it's like this practice is, I practice for you, you practice for me. I practice so I can be, when I'm with you, I can be the best friend I can be. And hopefully you're practicing for the same reason. And that's not selfish, that's selfish. That acknowledges interconnection. So it's so when people say, either because other people think they're being selfish to practice meditation or to go to a retreat, I say, either you're misunderstanding what the practice is about. It's not about an escape. It's about doing some very necessary work. So you can be a true human being. This is the most essential. And hopefully, if you're doing it right, it makes you a better person, makes you a better wife, better husband, better partner, better friend, better mother, better father, better colleague, better worker. The whole deal. If it's not, then you need to look at how you practice. Is this practice is about? It's about developing the capacity to be true human beings. To be happy. To be peaceful. To be open-hearted, compassionate, caring human beings. That's the end of it. And if we're just becoming more selfish, more self-centered, more cut off, more disconnected, then we're not practicing practice. We don't need to practice the Buddhist Dharma to be more disconnected, to be more selfish. We can just stay in the world. Any other questions that come to the end? It's very different. It's still far as cool. So just as good. Good questions. Yeah. Any other things in your mind?
Your mind. Anything not clear or anything else in terms of your own life and practice?
Good. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. First of all, thank you for your in my own practice, you know, I haven't been practicing for that long. It's wonderful that my fist is bringing me back to what reality is, because I'm writing it, you know, as you're talking, I'm practice retreats and mindfulness is not an escape but a return. It's almost like a return to the little perfect creature I was before the world got me. And I'm returning to reality versus the frightening fantasy that I've kind of bought into when I don't pay attention and I'm not real centered, when I'm not real focused. I've had the gift of having some friends that are very good at mindfulness and practice, and it was wonderful to hear when a Buddhist monk said to me that he gets monkey mind and he has a hard time focusing, and so I didn't feel bad, you know, because Abba said this to me, and it was helpful. And as far as how long it took, it comes and goes for me. And coming back in here, I realized, you know, wow, I've just really gotten away from it and became a human doing instead of a human being. And so it's wonderful to be here and to have this opportunity to get back in touch with what's really important. And I agree and appreciate you reminding me that it makes me a better person, and my most important job is as a mom. And, you know, I have an adolescent who's going into the rat race. So, willingly so. And I can sometimes get him to temple if they're serving Vietnamese soup. Because he likes to eat that. And, I think when I first started, I you know, really wanted to know everything yesterday, and wanted to push the river. I didn't want to wait for it to flow. And over time, over the last, I guess, 3 or 4 years, there's a lot to learn for me. And the idea of suffering, I thought, no, I don't want that. Thank you very much. I don't want you to wound up with a bunch of people talking about suffering, and the reality of it is I was suffering constantly. I was in so much pain emotionally and spiritually, and it wasn't until I kind of caught that piece of reality. No, that's not reality. You know, this is reality. And I love what you said about it, actually them allowing us to come closer together, because when I'm in that place in me, I can see that place in me.
Good. Yes, so I think my mom once said, it's that people talk about heavens or pure lands, you know, where there's no suffering. I said, I don't want to go there. Because a place that has no suffering has no connection. Has no compassion. A place that has no suffering has no compassion. So it is important that we stay present to our own suffering. It humanizes us, it softens us, it also gives us wisdom, because where there's suffering, there's liberation from suffering. And as Chip knows, it only takes about 5 or 10 seconds. For the little ones, the ones that take a little more. Please understand that every time you liberate yourself from suffering, that's a tiny one, you're having momentary nirvana. You're having a little taste. So when you wear those shoes that are a little too tight, take them off and you feel like you're having a little taste of nirvana in that moment, right?
taste should, what's your appetite? And again, what's your name?
Char.
And so the other point you made, I think, which is important, is that it is important when we begin to give our life opportunities like today, well, it's just sort of like daily meditation, even if you can just do it, if you're starting 5 or 10 minutes, those little breaks we talked about during the day when you come back to yourself, days of mindfulness, going to a meditation class during the week, going on retreats, you know, it gets bigger and bigger, more time. But if we do not, then we will just get swept away. Swept away by our thoughts, swept away by the activity of life, swept away by others, and we lose our center, our sense of reality. This is where we want to come from. This is why in the practice today, we're beginning very basic, right? Can I be with my body? Can I be with my own breath? Can I be with my own feelings? Can I be with my own sense of experience? That's my ground. And that's the place, therefore, that when I enter the world and interact, which is what we all do, I come from a place of stability and groundedness and centeredness. But if I don't have that, I'm just, you know, I'm just up in my thoughts and my head and my concepts and my feelings and everybody else. You know, I just get swept away. You know, I don't feel the balance and stand. So it's important, especially in the early stages of our practice, you know, to again establish a daily practice. Find the capacity throughout the day to practice mindfulness, you know, develop a relationship with some sort of a meditative or spiritual community that we can be nourished by. Take advantage of things like these in mindfulness, retreats, again, depending on your own life and your own, how important this is to you. But without it, it's very difficult, as we all know. And once you get to the point where you feel, well, I don't think I need that anymore, right? Good, then you show up for others. You just keep showing up. In the beginning, you may show up to Sangha or meditation because you know without it, your life goes astray. But when you stabilize yourself enough in the practice, then you show up to help others. So it is the 12:30. We're ending at 14. 4 o'clock we're ending?
Approximately.
So we have a wonderful afternoon. We can now do take a break. But again, maintain your silence, maintain your awareness, just enjoy being alive. Enjoy seeing and looking and smelling and tasting through your food. Stop screaming, take a walk outside, enjoy the earth, enjoy the feel of the grass, the trees, look at things, and really just look. Look at a leaf, look at a flower, look at the sky, take 5 or 10 minutes, you don't feel this body. Look at each other, you feel this body. And then around 1:30, John will ring, or somebody will ring that bell, you'll come back in here and do guided meditation and relaxation, and then after that we'll have mindful movement of the bowel, and then we'll have a short meditation and then our closing circle.